You're listening to the IM&M Intelligent Buildings podcast with founder and CEO of the IM&M Suite, Paul Wells.
Hello, my name is Paul Wells, and this is Paul from the series of podcasts looking at intelligent buildings. And I'm here today at WSP's office to talk to Matt Marston, Head of Smart Places, to discuss his view of intelligent buildings. Matt, many thanks for agreeing to talk to us today. If possible, we'd like to get your view as a smart building expert on the following questions. Question one, what are the benefits and risks of putting smart technology into a building in your view?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for having me. This is a question we tackle quite a lot with our clients here at WSP. So I think for the purposes of this answer, we'll frame it around a commercial office. And it really starts, I suppose, with what the client is trying to get out of their building. So that could be anything from the kind of hygiene factors that I just expect these days from smart buildings, if that's to do with energy, and in particular how you might want to look at optimising some assets, so if that's through the use of something like a heating, ventilation and air conditioning analytics system, that then, you know, if it's got some particularly jazzy algorithms, you'll be able to do some fault detection and diagnostics. So I think there's a whole kind of work stream that Hard FM and asset managers are interested in when it comes to operating that asset properly. Then if we kind of move up the food chain a little bit, end users in particular, and perhaps even some landlords, care muchly about their space utilisation. Most corporate offices have at least 25% of the space that they have that isn't really properly utilised. And for a landlord, that can give you some warning signs that perhaps if you've got like a break clause or something coming up, that there'll be some changes. Or for the end user themselves, how they can work that asset harder. It helps them, you know, to perhaps use a set of sensors to look at how people are moving, the popularity of spaces, to justify investment decisions, be that in end user technology or in different sorts of work settings. And then I suppose finally, on the kind of upper end of the spectrum, it's around what they can do for the people that work there. If that is around proving some of the metrics that the WELL standard kind of promises us, you know, if I know the quality of air that I'm giving in a space versus the natural light versus what we're doing with the water, and if I compare that to sip days that might be recorded in an ERP system of some description, it's now a case that I can prove that smart is delivering on the promises of the WELL standard. Or maybe it's something to do with productivity. And this normally starts a fight and a bit of a punch up in some of the clients that we speak to. But it's about defining what productivity is in the context of your organisation. So for a bank, it might be the number of transactions settled in an hour. For a software developer, it could be the number of releases in a week. And those sorts of things, I think you can certainly start to chip away at. So for one client, they had a fintech centre, and they were kind of asking this productivity question, and we boiled it down to kind of three things. The first one was innovation itself, which we measured through the number of patents they were filing or projects that were sold out of the centre. So nothing the building was really responsible for, but a good kind of testbed metric. The second one was around collaboration, where we use some Wi-Fi spatial analytics and looking at how the corporate mobile phones were moving around the building. So we could see that two people from different teams had some kind of meaningful interaction, we would increase that team's coefficient of collaboration. And we basically found the more they collaborate, actually, the better they score on their innovation target. And then the third one was to do with efficiency of the building. Everybody had this big gripe that the temperature was never right. So as part of the workplace app that we built them, they could vote for a change in temperature, which was hooked back up to the building management system, so it would kind of, you know, actuate that command automatically. But we'd taken the amount of time that a member of staff had spent on that page in the app and had times it by their day rate, and we went to go find the incumbent FM team that much for wasting the time of their staff and not being able to meet the requirements in temperature. So, yeah, I suppose it's stuff to do with energy, it's stuff to do with space, and how you can make it better for people in some way. That's why people really care about it. But on the risk side of things, yeah, there are loads. Particularly in the UK, I think we're laggards in its implementation because of how our construction industry is structured. Firstly, it's anti-innovation. Everything is so that you can sue somebody. You kick off a project and the first conversations are around blame before anything's even happened. And innovation is about the ability to try something and fail, and it's okay. And in the UK, in our construction industry, it's simply not acceptable. So unless, you know, I think we have these conversations where it's, I want innovation, but show me where you've done it 10 times before. And it's a bit like, those two don't really work. And then I think there's also a bit of snobbery in the sector that built environment professionals can deliver a smart building end to end. And I don't think we can. It takes a team to do that, because the whole thing about IoT is that it's devices connected to the internet. Only half of that you can actually touch. So yes, I think the construction industry, with a bit of support, some pain, will be able to solve the physical side to get the backbone into a building that's required. But I certainly don't want my builders building my software. We need to start working with more technology companies and come at it in the same way that techies do, to make the software give us the outcomes we want and to make it meaningful. And one of the biggest barriers I see that we kind of have to face is a really simple one. It's just how the difference between construction and technology do project management. Construction folks use a waterfall methodology. Things have to be done a certain order. You have to put your foundations in before you core, before you frame, before you wrap the thing up. Whereas in software, doesn't matter. That's what Agile is about. You change what you're doing along the way in order to respond to other pressures that you have. And trying to get Agile to match to waterfall is a bit of a nightmare. And it's that uncertainty that adds all of the risk, the danger money that the construction industry apply to that. And yeah, I think it's safe to say in the UK, we are really struggling to innovate because of the dinosaur mentality that's out there. I understand they've got, you know, backsides to cover, but at a certain point, we are going to be left behind.
Thank you very much. I think that's going to make people look up a bit, and hopefully it might make the industry change. So following on from that, what's your view of the JLL's 330-300 model?
I actually really like it. I think it articulates the orders of magnitude of the cost that a business incurred per employee quite well. So it basically says that you as a company, for everyone you've got, for a square meter, depends on how it's cut, the square foot, because it's American, obviously, that you will spend $3 on energy, $30 on the like rent and the space that you put your people in, and then $300 on the person that sells. And I think it just goes to show how small-minded we've been in trying to save energy when I could make a 10% saving on some of the people side by making the place better, and then I've just, you know, cleared out both space and the energy, you know, roughly. And the fact that it's given a dollar amount to it just resonates so much more than, you know, the kind of 90%, 9% and 1% that other models talk about. And it's quite an eye-opener when you present that to a real estate manager or a property developer, that actually some of the more intangibles do matter. Now, I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't care about energy, but what I'm saying is that doesn't excite me. If you're not doing the most that there possibly is for energy savings, then there's kind of no point us having a conversation. For me, it's a hygiene factor. And I think if we look at the massive change that we're having as consumers for some of our big name brands, if that's the likes of Nike now making shoes from recycled ocean plastics, the press we're seeing with Greta, who's sailed to New York to give the Americans a bit of what for, or people that I've actually seen in bars actively decline plastic straws, it's only a matter of time, I think, before those expectations are translated into the built environment. Then if we think about that model further, what I quite like is that it effectively helps you to build a business case in quite an easy way. If you can accept those three things as a premise, then it's really easy to test, you know, the cost of technology plus its software plus what we think the results will be, and sort of add those up to help you in a really simple kind of way that doesn't require a load of analysis, say whether or not you want to move forward with a project. Where I still think there's a little bit more work for it to be done is in the people side of things. Because sometimes I think there's a bit of a gut reaction that's, oh, does that mean like getting rid of people? And that's kind of not the point at all, because then if you got rid of the people, you wouldn't need the building in the first place. It's about making it better at delivering the outcomes that a human best thrives in. If that's the space being healthy, if that's it facilitating you getting on with stuff, or I quite like the way that Sodexo think about it, who are a facility management company. They talk about productivity leakage, which is all the stuff in the day that adds up, stops you from being helpful. If that's like waiting for the lift, or you know you want to go to the loo but it's being cleaned, or the Wi-Fi drops. They went as far to say as they think that most white-collar workers lose about 2 hours a day in productivity leakage, which is just nuts. That's a quarter of kind of your whole working day. Now, just because you give people back some of that time doesn't mean they're not going to talk about Love Island, but at least, you know, the option is there. And I think with the right technologies in place, you can start to prove some of that. You know, I've delivered a lift service that gets to floor within, I don't know, 20 seconds. We have taken the kind of usage data on the toilet so that we know when it's best to do this, so that we don't cause out time or people having to change floors and that sort of thing. Or, you know, we've delivered a network with, you know, 6.9s robustness or something. We can prove that now. And that's why it's just such a good framework to hang your hat off and put in front of the different folks within your organisation. Like your energy managers obviously care about the 3, your real estate managers care about the 30, and HR care about the 300. And I don't think we have a model that is as successful in uniting those different functions. I mean, a couple of years ago, Ericsson appointed a chief employee experience officer, and her role was to stitch together IT, FM, real estate, and HR. And I mean, just the change that they can go through with having those four players talking together must be pretty impactful on how someone experiences their job.
Thank you very much. I love that productivity leakage point. I think that's really important. I think that's great. So lastly, what would you like to see change in the building industry?
I think there's a couple of things that probably need to work together. The first one that I'm kind of struggling with is honesty. And there's just a lot of smart snake oil out there, if I'm honest. Everybody's got a new sensor that can make toast and read your mind, and it's not the case at all. Or they talk about this wonderful deployment that they managed in their basement, which we kind of both know is not going to scale to a full skyscraper. And because of some of the wheeler dealers, it means the rest of us are untrusted. And the kind of default position that people are taking, particularly when they're used to managing risk, is not to bother. So it's providing an almost impenetrable wall that people that do have experience can't get through because of the claims of some small companies. And if I'm being brutally honest, I don't even think it's just the small companies that are doing that. Some of the incumbent OEMs are essentially taking their old products, adding a jazzier user interface on top, and saying it's smart and that they've, you know, fundamentally re-architected it and it's using the kind of best and latest sort of website, when in fact they've just really rolled the turd in glitter and it's kind of not good enough. The next one that I think I'd like to see more of is around collaboration. And I don't just mean like a multidisciplinary project. Like, obviously there's going to have to be some of that and some standards and things are going to change. But I mean with people wider than the ecosystem that they're used to. So if that is a manufacturer of devices because they're going to install a particular sensor that does a thing. So for instance, one thing that worries me is if we want to do a full skyscraper with smart lighting and the process to get the thing commissioned is that you have to use a QR code on a mobile app and kind of position where that is on a map. To do that manually, I don't think we have the skills in the UK to do that at any form of scale at a competitive price. So how do we, you know, if that's involving upskilling a current delivery force or using a different set of people, that's a problem. I think we need to be more kind of tech literate as the construction industry. So for instance, we've got a client at the moment who rather bravely just sort of said, like, Matt, I'm really sorry, but I don't understand the words you're using. I'm a property developer. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not doing it to try and bamboozle you. These are, you know, the things we talk about in technology. So we've actually put together for them a smart school
And the whole idea is that by the end of their kind of little boot camp that we're doing over a set of weeks, is that they will know the difference between maybe three different flavors of location services. They'll understand the steps involved in creating a mobile app. They will know, you know, what is HTML5 versus Python versus Java, so that when a vendor comes to see them, they at least, you know, have some weapons to fight against the nonsense. And then I suppose it's also to do with partnerships with some of the big tech players. So if you are a contractor, for instance, and you are delivering the all of the wonderful kind of buildings we're putting up here in the UK, we are, I think, probably leading the way forward globally in the production of digital twins, where a digital twin basically takes your BIM, it adds some static data, if that's your O&M manuals, if it's, you know, some, you know, other bits and bobs that you need to know, warranties, blah, 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 with some live IoT data. And in order to do that, I don't think they've probably got the BIM expertise in-house, but they're going to need some help if that's buy or partner, or you grow something organically in order to do that. Like, the business model and the things they deliver will change and become more complex. So I suppose the final point kind of comes to them, the skills that are required to do it. I think we're out there looking for a set of unicorns, these people that have got all of the skills we'd expect in one person, when like a software company would never dream of doing that. You have hardware specialists, you have software specialists, you've got designers, you know, you can go as far as having people that specialize in how a person interacts with a design. You know, if you want to do some nice dashboards in a foyer that people can, you know, play and experiment with, that there's not just going to be a smart buildings man or woman that you can, you know, pull in house. It takes a whole team. So, for instance, one of the things that I'm really proud of here at WSP is the set of skills that we're building in our own smart places capability. They're kind of from all over. And I think one that I get the most sort of eyebrows at is that I hired somebody from a performing arts background to help us. Because when we're doing the first bit of design at the start of a project and we're trying to work out what does smart mean in your context, or, you know, how do we really put on the shoes of a user, the empathy that they have is so much more than I could get from a technologist. And that's what makes the designs really pop and why we were really confident with the technology that we've picked. So we kind of, all those things together, you know, the honesty, what the market's pumping out to us, the collaboration, the partnerships and the skills, like, it probably feels quite daunting. So I think it's just a case of everybody kind of relaxing a little bit. It's new stuff. You know, you don't always get right first time. It's going to be okay, hun. You know, give it a go.
Matt, thank you very much. That was really great. And it was very informative. Right? I learned a lot and it was humorous, and I think people will gain a lot from this. I'm sure people appreciate the podcast. I certainly do. And this is Paul Welbs and the fourth in the series of podcasts looking at intelligent buildings.
For more information about our intelligent building solutions, visit immsuite.com.